Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. The named daemon. Well, actually, it's the named daemon. It's bind. That's the package, and the package describes itself. Well, actually, Patrick Volkerding describes the package as the named daemon and support utilities such as dig, host, and nslookup. Sample configuration files for running a simple caching name server are included. That's huge. Documentation for advanced name server setup can be found in user doc bind version number. So let's take a real quick look at the package itself, like the contents. Well, no, first let's talk about DNS, just in case. I mean, I've talked about DNS a little bit on the show. I'm not an expert. There are people who know a lot more about DNS and the protocols involved and the communication methods than me. But we may as well just kind of level set. Here's DNS, right? This is the domain name something. I don't even know what it stands for. But then again, I rarely know what these three-letter acronyms stand for in tech. I just forget. So DNS, domain name system, and it is responsible for, it's the answer for how a computer within a network, how computers can translate IP addresses, just a string of numbers, to something a little bit more human-friendly, or I should say human-memorable. Humans have a hard time sort of associating seemingly random numbers to very specific things. I mean, it's quite astonishing that we still are using phone numbers. And interestingly, phone numbers really didn't start out as numbers as such. If you watch old movies or old TV shows from like the 40s and 50s, you'll know that people picked up the phone and just said, like, you know, give me Lexington 555 or something like that. And so a lot of the thing that you would have to remember is the physical location of the person you were calling. Well, I know that they're in Lexington, so, and their street address is 555, so that's what I'll ask for, or whatever. Or you would just ask the operator for the person that you want. Like in a small town, you could just ask just for them by name, and the operator would know. So it somehow numbers evolved, and we got away from just referring to people by mnemonics. But even today, I mean, if you think about where we really are, you pick up your cell phone, and you probably don't dial someone's number, you dial their contact. And your phone knows, because you've entered it in at one point, or they've called you and you've saved them as a contact, your phone knows who you're referring to. So even in our daily, sort of the thing that we talk about a lot, like a phone number, even then, today, we don't actually use the number as much as we do some other memorable token. And so DNS is a way to provide memorable tokens for computers on a network. And if you've ever messed around with a local network, you probably know, and this includes the sample network that I did in episode 555 or whatever it was, then you probably know that you can get from one computer to another computer by typing in its IP address. Now, typing in an IP address where do you type the IP address in? Well, you could that depends on the protocol that you want to use. You could type it into a web browser, and if that computer happens to be listening on the web browser port of 80, then you'll get in. You've reached that computer. If it doesn't have its web browser port open, then you won't get into the computer. And even if you do get into it, it's a read-only kind of situation. You're just looking at pages that they've placed in a specific directory for you to see. Another way is SSH. You can SSH to an IP address, and if they have their SSH port open and you have the key to get in, then you are in, and so on. Well, either way, if you're only dealing with 5 or 2 or 10 computers on a small local network, those numbers aren't that hard to recall. You might have little tricks of ways of remembering things, like if you're if you have a house and one computer is in your office, one is in the living room, and one is in the kitchen or the garage maybe, or your workshop, whatever. And now I've given myself lots of options. Maybe you've just numbered it 1, 2, 3 in your head in that order. And so you could go to 192.168.0.1 and you'd know, oh, that's the one in my office. 2, that's the one in the living room. 3, that's the one in the workshop or whatever. So you might come up with tricks like that. But the other way to do all of that is to come up with a domain name system. And local networks, you can come up with whatever system you want. There's kind of a tradition, a growing tradition really, of calling the computers on your personal network a domain .local. So you might have enterprise.local, yorktown.local, and excelsior.local, and so on. But in order for your network, even a small network, to know what those names are associated with, what IP address those names get associated with, you'd have to go into /etc/host or hosts. I always forget if it's plural or not. /etc/hosts, plural, yes. I mean, I guess that makes sense. You have to go into /etc/hosts and type in an IP address. 192.168.0.1 is office.myhouse.linux, myworkshop.myhouse.local, and so on. Or whatever I said for the domain name. So you have to establish that somewhere. And then you have to do that on every single computer. So if you do that for 3 computers, okay, it's a little bit of work, but it's pretty quick. If you do that for 10, it's starting to get a little bit painful. Do that for 20 or 100 or 6 billion, then that's a lot of work. So someone had to come up with a system where there was like one computer, or, you know, one cluster of computers, or a network of lots of computers that basically are serving the same information that all other computers could kind of reference before sending a message. So if you wanted to send a message, or if you wanted to forge a path to a specific web server called example.com, but you didn't happen to know the IP address of example.com, then you could just tell the computer, essentially, look, find out the phone number for example.com and then take me there. That's DNS. That's the system at work. You type in example.com into your web browser, and your computer secretly, quietly, behind your back, references a DNS server somewhere out there on the internet, finds out the number for example.com, and then goes to that number. All you have seen is that you have typed in example.com and you've magically ended up on the homepage of example.com. How did you get there? Well, you got there because your computer found out the number of the address of the network and the computer that it needs to go to. That's DNS. That's what it does. That's really it. Now, keep in mind that quickly, quietly, behind your back, referencing a DNS server, it does take time. And you don't think it takes that much time. I mean, it's just a quick, I mean, DNS, I mean, that's all it does, right? It serves numbers for or names for numbers. So surely it can't take that long, but it does start to add up, and you can get kind of surprised by how a little bit of a lag on a network, you know, even just a couple of microseconds, starts to feel like a serious lag. So the DNS system, or the DNS network, can introduce some lag time into your network, depending on where you are and how good your connection is and so on. But to solve that, and also to find a way to add custom addresses to your own DNS system without having to, or your domain name system, without having to purchase an official name and get it published on the DNS system. I mean, which you couldn't even do for like a .local address. Like that wouldn't make sense to ever go onto a public DNS system, domain name system, because it's specifically local within your network. No one can reach workshop.homelinux.local or whatever your network is called. So it wouldn't make sense to have that on the big global domain name system. For that reason, there are ways to run a DNS server locally on your network in a mode called through a method called a caching DNS server. And that's the thing that Pat includes a sample configuration file for in the named.conf file found in /etc. So really quick, before we look at that, we'll go to var log packages bind, bind-9.16.25, blah, 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 and take a look at the package contents. There are a bunch of files right up front in /etc. There are bind keys. There's the default directory with a named.new and named.conf.new. That stuff gets renamed from the .new gets dropped, assuming there's nothing custom existing in the system already. If you try to, for instance, if you uninstalled bind the bind package on Slackware and then created a file because you decided you wanted actually to do DNS yourself, you created a file called /etc/named.conf. Then when you reinstalled bind and it's got its own configuration file, it's called .new. So the system, the Slack package system, recognizes that it cannot, without destroying user data, rename named.conf.new to named.conf, and therefore it stops and asks you, the user, what you want to do. You can overwrite the changes, or you can keep your changes, but you can keep both and then figure out what you want to do manually later. Lots of different options. And that's an interactive prompt when you run Slack pkg install bind. But anyway, that's why they end in .new. There's also an rc.d directory, which of course is the init system for Slackware, and there's an rc.bind, again .new, but it gets renamed to rc.bind so that, you know, ideally it'll just replace whatever's there. So that's in the /etc folder. There's some stuff in bin, that's the user-facing binary stuff. So there's like ARPA name and dig and host and nslookup and a couple of others. And then there's the documentation as promised, and some include files and lib files and man pages, and there's sbin. So user sbin has a bunch of things like DNS secure, DNS sec, a couple of different applications for that, like keygen and key manager and revocation applications and ways to sign your key and so on. And then there's also, most significantly, I guess, user sbin named. And also really useful applications like named-checkconf, so that you don't come up with something ridiculous in your configuration file and then expect it to work without checking or confirming, verifying it first. I love programs like that. There's a couple of the big demons have that kind of check configuration executable, and I just love them because they just save you so much trouble. Or it's weird. It saves you a lot of trouble, but when you run it, you feel angry at it because it finds your errors, and that means you have to work harder and figure something out. So there is a conflict there, but ultimately, at the end of the day, trust me, you learn to love it very quickly. All right, so let's take a quick look here at what Pat has in named.conf, because this is kind of a masterclass in how this stuff works. I'll skip over the options, although that's not a bad thing to look at as well. There's a good, pretty nice comment in there just kind of reminding you about firewalls. And that is something, I mean, I forget it all the time, both, you know, a firewall running on your machine or the firewall running on your router on the perimeter of your network. A lot of firewalls, they don't expect incoming DNS requests. They expect DNS requests going out, and obviously the answers that come that are returned with that request, but it doesn't expect an incoming net new, nobody asked for this DNS request. And I mean, if you're setting up a cache, a DNS caching server in your own network, you don't have to worry about the outside world. No one's using this DNS server but yourself. But you might have to worry about the computer that you're running it on. If you're running it on something other than Slackware that just throws a firewall up without asking you. I mean, I'm not saying that in a negative way. I mean, that's a very useful feature for a lot of things. And if that's there, then you have to remember to go in and add that service, the DNS service, as something that you're okay with, you know, assuming that you want to be able to query it, you need to open up a port. So that's a good thing to remember. Okay, so aside from that little bit of a reminder, the options, the first big sort of clause or stanza in this configuration file, /etc/named.conf, is zone parentheses dot parentheses, no, not parentheses, quote, zone space quote dot close quote in curly brace. So that this is the scope of the zone known as dot, which is that's the start, that's the beginning. It's a little bit like the slash of a file system. That is the start of the domain name system. It starts with a dot. So this is the top tier of your domain name server. Zone dot in curly brace type hint. That value, that key and value pair, type hint, that's telling Bind that this zone, the start of DNS for authoritative answers, here's where you need to look. And the next line says exactly where to look. File, quote, caching dash example slash name d dot root, close quote, semicolon. Okay, so what is that file? Well, if you go back to the package listing in var log packages bind dash 9.16 blah, you do find, if you look around at the very bottom of the file, var name d slash caching dash example slash name d root. So it's a file that the package installed on your computer. You've probably never really noticed it before or had any reason to think about it, but it is there. If you've got Bind installed on Slackware, it's there. If you're running Bind on Slackware as a caching server, then this file is being used by Bind. And if you look in it, if you just do a most on slash var slash named slash caching dash example slash named root, you see that it, and I think it does say at the top of the, yeah, this file holds the information on root name servers needed to initialize cache of internet domain name servers. So you need to reference this file in the cache dot file configuration file of bind domain name servers. That last sentence wasn't as helpful as I thought it was going to be. But anyway, you can look through the file. It's not that long, but it does name a bunch of name servers that your computer can use to get authoritative answers about domains. So that's part of the DNS network that exists out there to help the internet, well, to help people on the internet find one another, or I guess more specifically, to help computers on the internet find each other according to their human name and number. So that's the zone, that's the top level zone. And the top level zone of our local configuration essentially points back to a file placed on our computer by smart people who configure this sort of stuff, like Pat Volkerding, to let our computer know where to go in the world if it needs to get a name for a number for a name that you're that a user has typed in. That's where that information is coming from. All right, next zone. Zone is localhost. Now, this is interesting. The zone localhost in curly brace and then a definition, that's different. That's not a type hint. That's a type master. Why would that be a type master? Well, this is only for localhost. This isn't going to be ever, this isn't referring to this file to go out to the internet to look for names and numbers. This is exclusively for what we are doing. Where's this file? Var slash name d slash caching file. There we go. Localhost, this is purely for stuff happening within the computer, right? And that, of course, defines, as you might expect with the name localhost, that defines 127.0.0.1 and what to do when it receives that name. All right, so that's pretty simple. And then finally, there's zone 0.0.127.in-adder.arpa in curly brace, and it defines, again, it says that this zone represents an authoritative zone. So it says it's the type master. And what is this authoritative for? Again, it is for the local host, but it's the reverse of the local host. It is local host defined for like the name local host. This is the entry for local host, not the number, the actual string, LOCALHOST. That wasn't a string. Was it a string? That was a string of characters. But this is an important example. I mean, the definition of 127.0.0.1 and the definition of localhost back to 127.0.0.1, that's kind of the model more or less. And then the difference between master and hint, for instance. So if you wanted to, for instance, this is a caching server by default. That's what this is designed to do. You start up bind, or rather named, and you've got a caching server. Brilliant. Once you've been to one place, then it caches it, and it doesn't have to go out onto the internet to find the thing, and everything's faster. What if you want to add your own domains to your domain name system? How do you do that? Well, you've got an example. You've got the localhost example here. So following Pat's lead, it would be, first, you would have to define two zones, right? One for the name, one for the number. So zone, quote, home linux.local in, curly brace, type master, because this is the authoritative server. There's no other server in the world that knows what home linux.local is. Even if you've seen home linux.local used out there in code samples, like, because of that .local, it means that specific home linux.local is the one existing in that author's home network. So home linux.local on your network is your home linux.local. Home linux.local on my network is my home. Never will they become confused, because they're two different networks and they don't know about each other. So this is type space master semicolon. This is the authoritative record record for this zone. And then the next line, of course, is exactly, again, just like in the localhost thing, we have to just point it to the file that we want it to refer to for more information. So file space, quote, trying to map this to the existing things. So I think it's localhost.zone. So this would be home linux.zone. No, sorry. Quote, caching-example/home linux.zone, close quote, semicolon, curly brace, semicolon. Next zone is the reverse. So just as we have the reverse for localhost or 127.0.0.1, but you're doing the whole network. You're not just doing a host. So zone space quote 0.168.192. I'm assuming that the host is at 192.168.0.1 and that the network, therefore, broadly speaking, is 192.168.0.0. But for whatever reason, the convention here, zone, quote, 0.168.192.in-addr.arpa, close quote, in, curly brace, and then again, the type is master. No other server in the world is going to point you to something within your own network. So type space master semicolon. File space quote caching-example. And the convention here, that we've got in this example is name d.local. So let's do home linux.local. Close quote semicolon. Allow-update, curly brace, none semicolon. Close curly brace semicolon. Close curly brace semicolon. Actually, allow update on both of those zones would be appropriate. Actually, okay. So you've got the references now in the configuration file, but those files that we have referred our configuration to, well, they don't exist yet. So you'd have to create them. Now, luckily, you've got sort of the beginning of at least a template with these example files. You would want to look at the localhost.zone file first for your home linux.zone file, probably basically copying and pasting the bulk of that would work up until the point where you're saying, oh, localhost gets mapped to 127.0.0.1. So instead of $origin localhost, you would put $origin home linux.local. That defines sort of the domain there. And then you want to define specific hosts within this network. So you could have, for instance, you've got a name records. So certainly you could do localhost a 127.0.0.1. That way, if you ever typed in localhost.homelinux.local, then it would still take you to localhost. That would be handy, maybe. Or, you know, if you had a setting wrong on your router or something and it was swapping out your domain names, that just ensures that the host called localhost is still mapped to 127.0.0.1. So that's kind of a useful thing to include. But you could do things like, you know, workstation A 192.168.0. Or did I say workstation was already one? Let's say, you know, office.homelinux.local. So we'll just define office as the host name. And then it's an A record. So you put A and then 192.168.0.3. And now when you go to office or office.homelinux.local, you'll be sent, according to this file, you'll be sent to 192.168.0.3. And you could do another one, kitchen A 192.168.0.4. And then when you go to kitchen or kitchen.homelinux.local, you get sent to 192.168 and so on. You can also define your own, like, you know, your own name servers and mail servers here. Within your network, you can also create CNAMEs that point not to a an IP address, but to a server on your network, such that that server might be hosting a website. So you go to intraweb.homelinux.local, and instead of going to a specific IP address, you get referred to myserver.homelinux.local, which happens to be running Apache server with a domain on it called intranet, and then you're there. You're at port 80 looking at the website. Okay, so that's that file. And then, of course, just like localhost, you need to do the reverse of all of that. In this example, I've said that that's going to be in caching-example/homelinux.local, I think, right? Because that's what, let me double check. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what I said, because that's what the example says. Yeah, named.local. So I'm saying homelinux.local. That's going to be the reverse pointers. And this, again, same deal. Like if you look at named.local, there's the headers right there. Like just copy and paste the start of that up until the point where everything starts talking about localhost. And instead you're going to define things like $origin 0.168.192.in-adder.arpa. You can set the time to life to whatever. I think Pat has it set to 86,400. And then you've got that little table of weird looking values. And of course, that instead of localhost dot and root.localhost dot, it would be workstation.homelinux.local. Define the name server, which I'm going to assume is the DNS thing that you're running. So that would be NS, name server NS. And then the value for that would be workstation.homelinux.local. Trailing dot after that. And then your hosts. And these hosts are defined there, that you have to imagine 192.168.0.something. So you're going to use the dot something. So I think in my example, I said that the office computer was going to be 3 and the kitchen computer was going to be 4. I don't know who has a computer in their kitchen. There used to be this thing when I worked at a computer store, people would always come in, they would need a computer and a TV for their kitchen. I could never understand why. Anyway, so that would, we would list them in numerical order here, starting with the first relevant one. So if we had no, well, we probably do have one, right? One is, I think I said earlier, one is workstation.homelinux.local. That's this one. So one, and then tab or space or whatever, PTR pointer, and then tab or space or whatever, workstation.homelinux.local. Okay, we skipped two, I don't know why. So let's say three, PTR office.homelinux.local. Four, four space pointer PTR space kitchen.homelinux.local. And then if you had other hosts there, you know, you would list them here by just that trailing number, just their last number. So 192.168.0.112 would be listed as 112, and then indentation PTR indentation migrate host.homelinux.local. dot. That's it. That's that file. So now you've got both files. You've got files with names pointing to IP addresses, and you've got designations pointing back to names. And you've got a centralized configuration file, that's the /etc/named.conf. You've got that file pointing, you know, identifying both of those files as being related and as being authoritative. Of course, for any of this to be useful, you have to point your computers to it as their domain name server. If your computers aren't referencing this, this isn't like a DHCP server that kind of monitors the network and hands out addresses. This is DNS. You have to tell your computers to go here first. And that would just be you going to your computer, probably configuring, if it's a laptop, you'd probably configure a specific network to use a specific DNS server. Or you could do it on your router so that all computers on the network use that DNS server. Because obviously you wouldn't want to try to use your 192.168.0.1 server out in the real world. That, again, would not work. It's a local network address that just doesn't make sense anywhere else. But within your own network, that's where you would want to go first. And because it's a caching server, it'll look up in its own little cache for addresses that it already knows about and go out to the internet for more information if it's lacking something. And if you've added your own hosts to it and your own zone that defines your own little subnetwork, then now it knows about all those addresses as well. And it's, as you can see, I mean, this has been 30 minutes and maybe it's not, maybe you don't have a complete picture of it, but I mean, it isn't that hard. If you look at some of these configuration files, I will completely agree that they are ugly, ugly files. They are not fun to look at. I don't think they're terribly well designed. I think that they could be better. It's just my opinion, but that's how I feel about configuration files, is that they should be quite explicit. The computer doesn't care what they look like. You can make the computer parse whatever you want, but a nice, clear sort of configuration for the humans, I think, is awfully nice. And I don't think that all of these sections are beautiful and easy to parse, like the the values 20040621 3 for your serial thing, and the refresh rate of 28800, and which is actually 8 hours, and so on. It's just that's too much. That's not beautiful. In SOA, what is SOA? Never, that doesn't say anywhere. Who knows what SOA is? Just it's an acronym, like all other acronyms in tech. You just put your belief in the power of acronym and you just assume it means something meaningful. That said, though, especially with this caching example present on your system and working on your system, you could start that up, configure your computers to look at it, and see what happens, and then play around with adding your own zone. It's pretty cool. And like I said, there are commands here to help you check the configuration files. So you don't have to make a change and then hope it works and hope you don't break your network for everyone. You can check the configuration files to make sure that it's at least a valid configuration. You might have done something wrong, like defined a name server out there that doesn't exist or something, but at least you'll find out whether it's going to, you know, threaten to break your network. So try it out, I guess, is what I'm saying. Bind. It's a really cool little powerful system. I've run a couple of different DNS caching servers over the years, and Bind was the last one that I tried because it just seemed so complex, largely because of those configuration files, to be perfectly honest. But once I actually gave it a go, I was really, really pleasantly surprised. I found it a lot easier, and it was all because of these example files. Like, that was exactly what did it for me. So, well, that, and I mean, I did read the documentation as well. There's great documentation out there. The Oracle documentation on it is quite good. I don't know where they got their documentation. They probably didn't write it themselves, but they might have. Who knows? Maybe they actually did produce some content for a change. But it is really good documentation. And there's actually, yeah, that's the one that I think. Well, and there's a GitHub gist, which I will link to in the show notes as well. It's very, very good. So between all of that stuff, I think this is manageable. What also is very, very manageable is getting a cup of coffee, a well-deserved cup of coffee. Let's go do that. We'll come back and finish up the show. And I'm back. I have a cup of coffee. I've got Turkish coffee today. It is coffee that I bought from a Turkish store. There's this place in Dunedin called Huzer Kebab. You can go there. Huzerkebab.co.nz. Huzer Kebab. It's a Turkish cafe and kebab joint, obviously. They have the best kebabs. I went there for the kebabs. I stayed there for the coffee. Well, actually, I didn't stay there for the coffee. I just get the kebabs and go. But they sell at the counter Turkish coffee, Turkish delight, dolmas, and lots of other things. So I stock up whenever I'm there, and I try to go there as often as I can, but it's not super close, so I don't get out there all that often. But yeah, their kebabs, best kebabs anywhere. I mean, that I've ever been. I haven't been to all kebab places, so I can't really say too emphatically that it's like the best in the world or anything, but it is absolutely, I mean, it is as, I have yet to taste a better kebab than their kebab. And this coffee is really, really quite good. Okay. And you know, I mean, I've talked about this before. Turkish coffee, Russian coffee, Greek coffee, whatever you call it, whatever nation lays claim to it. It's like this finely powdered dusting of coffee that you just dump into a briki, put on the stove, boil it, and you wait until it sort of froths and foams. It just does that on its own for some reason. I don't know why. And then you pour it into a mug. You're done. I guess a lot of people put a bunch of sugar in it. I don't know. I don't do that. But I have heard from a lot of people that that's kind of like the way to do it. It's just I'm not really used to sweet coffee. That's just not generally a flavor that I'm too fond of. So I mean, there are exceptions for everything. But generally speaking, if I'm making myself a cup of coffee, I'm not in the mood for something sweet. All right, moving on to the next one, Blues, B-L-U-E-Z. These are a bunch of libraries and utilities for dealing with Bluetooth, and I do mean dealing with. I'm not a fan of Bluetooth. I should say, I'm not a fan of Bluetooth in how it is implemented. Like, I don't know what it is about Bluetooth. It just doesn't really seem like it's very reliable. So I don't know if it's just not good tech, or if the software just isn't good, or a mixture of both. I don't know. I just know that I rarely use Bluetooth and think, wow, this is so great. I mean, I appreciate sometimes the lack of wires. That I will admit, that is nice. But there are just so many times where it's just not working as smoothly as you want it to. And it's frustrating. And in fact, these utilities in the Blues package, the reason I know them in real life, like, I didn't have to prepare for this segment, like, I know these tools because Bluetooth is just so unreliable. I always end up, not always, that is hyperbole. I frequently end up just going to the terminal and doing something myself with HCI tool, HCI dump, HCI attach. I don't even know what HCI stands for, to be honest. Never thought to check that out. What does it stand for? HCI attach. Attach serial devices via UART HCI to BlueZ stack. Still don't know what HCI stands for, but there you go. Okay, so you can do cool things with HCI tool. Oh, right. Well, let's really quick look at the package in var log packages / blues-5.63 blah. So that's it's got some configuration files. It's got an rc.bluetooth file so that you can start the daemon. It's got a kernel module or it looks like it has a kernel module configuration file. I don't know what that's for. Oh, here it is. Bluetooth D. That's the actual module, and that's in user lib exec. And then it's got a bunch of stuff in bin, user bin. There's Blue Moon, Bluetooth Cuddle, BT Attach, BT Mon, CIP Tool. A lot of these I don't know. GAT Tool, HCI Attach, HCI Config, HCI Dump, HCI Tool, Hex2HCD, L2 Ping, L2 Test, MPRE Proxy, RC Test, RFCOM. I think I've actually used RFCOM before as well. And SDP Tool. So these are kind of... I imagine they're probably primarily thought of as like troubleshooting tools, but I mean, like I say, you can actually like the line in Bluetooth, the line between just using something and troubleshooting something is very, very blurred. HCI tool scan, I think is what I do first. Now, because Bluetooth is designed to sort of work in bursts. I mean, not once it's attached, but like when attaching and when pairing and things like that, it happens in bursts. So sometimes it is difficult to, and this is part of the frustration, I think. Sometimes it's difficult to kind of like catch Bluetooth at the right moment. But I don't know. I find that sometimes the very verbose and useful information that the terminal commands provide can sometimes give me a little bit of a reassurance that yes, these two devices are seeing each other, they're hearing each other, they're just not at the right stage yet, or oh no, they tried and failed. You know, yeah, I don't know. I don't find that it helps with reliability, but I do find that it provides more meaningful feedback for me. You might agree, you might disagree. You might think, eh, this isn't that much better. Or you might be perfectly happy with Bluetooth, in which case, great, good, I'm glad, because I'm not. But I mean, that doesn't mean it's not working for everybody. It's just one of those things. So, okay, how to use these tools? Well, a lot of them are deprecated officially by the BlueZ maintainers. So a lot of these you probably won't be using. I mean, you could do like an HCI tool scan to see the devices around you, or rather to see devices that are communicating in your general direction around you, because it does seem to be a little bit dependent upon sort of what mode the Bluetooth device is in. So that's a bit tricky. The one that I find to be kind of most useful lately is Bluetooth Cuddle or Bluetooth Control. That's the word Bluetooth CTL. Bluetooth CTL. That one is, interestingly, it's kind of an interactive, it opens up an interactive prompt. And then, do you have to launch that with, I don't think you have to launch it with sudo. No, you don't. You just type in Bluetooth Control or Cuddle CTL, and the agent becomes registered, and I take that to mean that it's sort of opening sort of an API session with your Bluetooth daemon, which in turn is, of course, you know, communicating with the firmware and then the Bluetooth chip in your computer. And the first thing that I do at that interactive prompt, and it doesn't have to be interactive, you can do this as a command, but I find that it boils down to being interactive anyway, because if you try to do everything in one command, then you do silly things like using a semicolon or an ampersand, because you really can only proceed to the next step as long as you've gotten the information that you expect to get. And half the time, for me at least, the problem is that the devices haven't sort of registered with each other yet. And so you're trying to connect before the computer realizes that there's a headset nearby. So Bluetooth Cuddle gets you into an interactive prompt. The first thing you'd want to do is scan on is what you type scan space on. If you just type in scan, it's fine. It'll just tell you you're missing the on or the off argument. So you scan on, and then that kicks it into discovery mode. So now it's actively scanning for devices that are, as I understand it, sort of, you know, looking to pair. So turn on scanning and then put your Bluetooth device that you're trying to attach to your computer into pairing mode. Lots of different devices do this differently. They have different little LED signals. You'll forget which one does what, because you'll have thrown away the documentation by then, and the documentation probably wasn't very good anyway, and it was probably just illustrated and was trying to communicate advanced concepts to you without any words. So anyway, eventually you'll figure it out. You'll get the thing into pairing mode, and your computer has scanning turned on, so now you can type in at the Bluetooth control prompt, you can type in devices, and that lists all of the devices. And sure enough, that's exactly what it did for me. It showed me the devices that it knows about. Now, if you already know that a device has been paired with your computer, you can just do I think it's paired-devices. So instead of devices, just paired-devices. That lists the things that are paired. But I'm assuming right now you're not doing that. And so instead, you would do a pair, and then the MAC address of the device that is looking for something to pair with. Once it's paired, and you can list that with paired-devices, you can connect to it. To connect, you do a connect, C-O-N-N-E-C-T, and then the MAC address of the thing that you want to connect to. It connects, you get the signal on the device that it is connected, or it just starts working, whatever kind of feedback the programmers have designed into that device, and now you've connected to a Bluetooth device through this Bluetooth control sort of API. And it works. I'm not saying that it is necessarily sort of a magical process by any means. It is not something, and type exit or quit to get out of the prompt. This isn't like the thing to make Bluetooth work for you. This is just a way to, a different tactic to use while fighting with Bluetooth. I've used it on some of my Raspberry Pi-like devices because I've got like a Bluetooth keyboard that I use with some of these devices, and it just never seems to work if I, you know, it's just, I don't know what it is. I can just never get the things to actually sync up. But if I see it being done on the device, and the specific device that I'm talking about actually has a built-in keyboard, so I type in these commands with my thumbs on this thing, and it attaches to the Bluetooth keyboard through this series of commands of prompts with Bluetooth control, and that's the most reliable way that I have to get this Bluetooth keyboard that I like to use with this one little chip, this little sock system. That's the way that it works. So that's Bluetooth control. There are lots of other applications in the package, but like I say, they're not necessarily all meant for everyday use, according to the development team. I'm not really sure how to tell, you know, one from the other. Like, it's not like they say this is a deprecated tool, but a lot of them are useful for different things. BTMon, that's a Bluetooth monitoring tool. HCI dump, it dumps HCI data. So there's a bunch of tools in there in the package that are probably useful for troubleshooting or maybe just a different workflow. But yeah, I have heard that a lot of them are deprecated and might not be updated. So use them, I guess, with caution. You know, don't start to rely on them too much. As I don't know, I've been using Bluetooth control for I feel like at least 5 years, and it's stuck around. So I'm pretty happy with it personally. I mean, as happy as I can be with Bluetooth. And to be clear, I don't think that this is a shortcoming of Blues, the team that maintains, you know, all of the Bluetooth packages for Linux. I'm not saying that they're at fault here. I'm saying that Bluetooth itself, I think as a protocol, I'm theorizing, just isn't that great. And again, I don't know if it's like literally the technology that's not ideal for what it's being used for, or whether it's just not standardized enough across different implementations. I really don't know. I just know that I don't much care for it. I mean, I guess, you know what, it must be something about the software in general, because I do have like a game controller that has like one of those little Bluetooth, I guess it's Bluetooth, a dongle, and that works great. You plug the dongle into the USB port and it sees the controller instantly. Your computer treats it like a USB device. It works brilliantly, like no problems, no delay, no question. And I've got a mouse like that. So I've got a couple of things that have a dongle, and you know, you'd think, oh, well, that's going to take up a port, and it does, but it's worth it because it works so brilliantly. And I kind of almost wish that was kind of like the standard practice or something, or else that Bluetooth was standardized or open or whatever needs to happen enough for all implementations to be equally good. I don't know. That's, I just don't love Bluetooth. What can I say? So the next package is Blues firmware. That's firmware to make the chips work on Linux. Not everything needs it, but I guess a lot of chipsets do have special firmware that you have to load into some place to get the thing to work with Linux. That used to be an everyday thing for me, not for Bluetooth, with Wi-Fi. That used to be something that you had to do all the time back in like 2012 or so. But those days are behind me. Luckily, all the Wi-Fi that I've gotten works really well on Linux, and you don't have to do anything weird with firmware extraction or anything like that. It's just right there. Everything that you need is there, and it is quite nice. Let's talk really quick about, no, let's not talk about BootP. So I guess that is the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.